I really tried to do, eat better and a healthier diet and take vitamins and stuff.
Okay, did Marcus do it?
Good, great.
Will the Judiciary Committee please come to order? President, our Senator Adams, Senator Collins, and myself, I believe Senator Rohde will be right back. We're here for a presentation from the Attorney General's Office on the status of cases involving sovereignty and the state constitutional jurisdiction. Some interest has been raised by the recent Tyonic decision. Mr. Attorney General, would you join us at the end of the table and bring whoever you want to have speak to us, and we'll go from there at your direction. We are on a listen-only teleconference, so if you just push the switch up, the small switch away from you. And I'm sorry if in the back you can't hear very well. The PA system has apparently got feedback problems. They are trying to see what they can do with that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like Deputy Attorney General Bruce Botello and Assistant Attorney General Gary Amendola to join me at this table. I am not an expert in native law, or indeed, for that matter, so far as I've been able to conclude any other area of the law. But I would like to make some preliminary remarks about the native sovereignty issue in Alaska. I expressed generally the view of the governor and his administration in remarks which I made in Barrow last weekend. I would like those remarks to be made a part of this record, if I may. They are contained in printed form, and I have a copy here which is now being handed to Senator Collins and Senator Adams and the chairman. But let me summarize, if I may, those remarks. We started about 1971 with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which many students of the field felt that it was generally dispositive of many of the major outstanding issues on this subject in Alaska. Generally, there were to be no reservations in Alaska except Metlakatla. Natives here would not be treated as wards of the federal government. Native-owned lands was to be subject to state law. And Alaska Natives were to be equal citizens of the state. And at that time, the combination of municipal corporations and the Native Claims Settlement Act corporations were going to bring new benefits, prosperity to Alaska and the native villages. And generally, as the governor has said often, we were to be one country and one people. But it was not long after the enactment of the Native Claims Settlement Act that claims were being made that Native villages were to be treated the same as Indian reservations in the lower 48, and along the way, even more extreme claims came to be made. And as a result, in my view, there has been widespread confusion and a plethora of litigation. And the result in my view of that litigation, has been only added confusion. Some decisions of the courts have rejected the notion of native sovereignty outside of reservations. Other courts seem to implicitly accept native sovereignty. And there have been conflicting decisions among courts, particularly, I might say, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And in my view, as a result, we are worse off than where we started in 1971 with respect to knowing what the fundamental law of native sovereignty is in Alaska. A good example of my remarks in that regard is the recent Tyonek decision. There, a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit decided the case involving the Tyonek Village Council, which involved whether the council could enforce its ordinance banning non-natives from residing in the village. The decision of the Court of Appeals did not address that question, but in the course of its opinion, made some far-reaching comments about Indian country in Alaska. And the opinion raised considerable concern as to whether Indian country exists in other parts of Alaska, and if so, where. And there are those who are familiar with the decision which are of the view that all Native Claims Settlement Act Village Corporation land may be Indian country. I personally don't agree with that view, but exactly what and where Indian country in Alaska is certainly unsettled at this time. Let me say this about my view of that decision. I think from a standpoint of judicial craftsmanship, the opinion deserves a C-, although that may be charitable. Perhaps it should not even receive a passing grade. I think that the court dealt in a very superficial fashion with respect to what constitutes Indian country and in Alaska. But in addition, deserving extremely low marks, the opinion, in my view, is in conflict with other fairly recent opinions of other panels of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. In other words, in my view, the several panels of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit simply can't get their act together with respect to native law in Alaska. And in my view, it's going to be necessary for the Supreme Court of the United States to give the Ninth Circuit some help in laying down and establishing the law on these issues in Alaska. What is the status of the Tyonek case now? First, the state of Alaska was not a party in that case. and therefore it has no standing to petition the United States Supreme Court for the court to hear that case. Unlike appeals in Alaska, where there is in civil cases, there's an automatic right to appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. In most civil cases in the federal system, the United States Supreme Court only hears such cases on appeal as it decides to hear. So that means that the losing parties, or any one of the losing parties in the Tione case, may file an application with the United States Supreme Court asking the court to hear the Tione case. If that application should be made, and it may be made generally within 90 days from the date of the decision, the state will join in the application to the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. Whether the court will hear the case is difficult to predict. But given the confusion in the Ninth Circuit over these issues, the court is apt to hear the case. It's already been once before the United States Supreme Court and then remanded to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. If the court agrees to hear the, quote, appeal, close quote, the state of Alaska will seek permission to appear as amicus curiae, friend of the court, and it will ask the court in that capacity to reverse the case. Now, what else does that portend to the state's position with respect to the native sovereignty claims and litigation? The governor has said, we all know well, that he views this state as one country, one people. And he is firmly opposed to the splintering of this state into scores, at least scores, of sovereign political entities. And therefore, the state will continue to oppose claims of sovereignties arising from such claims, certainly until the law in that field is settled. The governor is also of the view that the issues perhaps which underlie claims of native sovereignty are best addressed not in litigation, but by the political process, and that problems of rural justice, problems of clean water, sewage, and the general problems which arise in rural Alaska are best addressed by way of legislation and agreements worked out among the various parties. And therefore, that is the position which I believe we can look forward to with respect to these claims of native sovereignty. That generally concludes my remarks. I would be pleased to address broad questions of policy.
Broad questions of policy?
Yes. Myself, personally, we have those who are of greater knowledge and ability in this areas of the law than I, to whom you may, with my blessing indeed, address more specific questions. But I do want to say preliminarily that was a rather amazing list of legal questions which were contained in your letter of February 18th, and I would say it would take us quite a while to furnish you with legal insight in response to those. Thank you.
Okay, and I hope we're going to go through the list of your previous written response when we get beyond questions to you directly, though. But Senator Adams, to Attorney General Cole.
Yes. Since the state is not a party and does not have no standing in the Tione case, you made a statement that you're not an expert in native law. And since the state was a friend of the court in Tione, is that to say that the Hickel administration is not a friend to the native people in our state?
Well,
to try to reverse this particular case.
Senator, if you will, please, I'd be pleased to respond to your question. A, the answer to your question is a flat no. B, the Hickel administration is a friend of the native people in Alaska in that it seeks to better the lot of native people in Alaska. As you know, the governor has traveled widely in the villages throughout the state. He is familiar with the problems facing rural Alaska and those who live there. But he is of the view that the solution to the problems there is not by way of litigation, that litigation is expensive, it lends confusion and disruptions, drives people apart, in some ways perhaps along white versus native lines, rather than to bring them together in a process of reasoning. And for that reason, the administration does not favor the result in Tione. And let me say something else about that Tione decision, lest there be any doubt in my view about my views. It's simply unacceptable, Senator, in 1991 for any group to seek to exclude under the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alaska peoples of a different race. That's what's so terribly wrong about the underlying Tionic litigation. We just simply can't have that in the state of Alaska, and it's entirely unacceptable.
Mr. Chairman, to continue the concerns expressed here this afternoon by the Department of Law that this particular case, I think, is exaggerated. What the department and this administration is doing is trying to create fear among and between its residents. And you can go back and look at the statements that you had made in the news media stating the word this decision could start from balkanization, meaning the breaking up into regions, into small hostile units. Now, what were you referring to in this particular statement that you made to the media? Where in the state of Alaska, what communities are hostile? And what evidence do you have that this will occur on your particular statements that you made to the media?
Let me respond to that, Senator. I welcome the opportunity to do that, and thank you for pounding that question to me. I said that in the view of the governor, and in my view, that the future of this great state does not lie into splintering it into scores of different groups based primarily along racial lines. I further said, when I was accurately quoted, that the decision requires a review of state policies in rural Alaska. Because when the state deals with sovereigns which are immune from suit, the state must be certain that it is in a position to enforce its agreements with those sovereigns. And furthermore, I said that dealing with matters coming within the Clean Water Act and CERCLA, it is necessary to review that decision and the impact that it has on that legislation. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Sorry, but I think that particular statement is ridiculous, that even in the Tioni case, that they have stated that it's Indian country. Isn't it true that even if every Native community in our state of Alaska was Indian country, that the state of Alaska would still retain full criminal justification over the state under a federal law?
Well, let me answer that, Senator, if I may. And there again, I'm glad you raised that question, because I note there's confusion. But I am bombarded virtually daily with letters from various parties in interest who say, what are you doing trying to enforce state hunting and fishing laws down in the lower Kuskokwim as against these Native peoples? You know, don't you know that you can't do that? So it's one thing to say in the paper and to have Will Mayo and others claim, you know, this decision has no effect on the powers of the state of Alaska to enforce its civil and criminal laws. But it's another thing when I am required by the Alaska Constitution and the statutes enacted by the legislature to enforce the rights of the state of Alaska, and am faced with claims from the litigants which are directly contrary to the publicly pronounced views of various Native parties. So it is not so clear when you come to act in my position with respect to these claims.
Maybe I am missing the particular point. Maybe I should have started from having the Attorney General's office interpret for me what is sovereignty to Hickel administration and to Department of Law.
Well, maybe should have, but we didn't get started that way, so that's the reason I'm responding in the fashion in which I am.
Would you give me a definition for how you interpret sovereignty?
Basically, if you look at claims of Native sovereignty, you start with the proposition that the claims of sovereignty arise from sovereign immunity. That means they're a sovereign, independent political body, immune from suit. That's the starting point, is it not, Senator? I mean, that's my understanding.
Well, that's a debate we will take. Isn't it true that we follow under sovereignty, that we follow some type of federal guidelines as our guides to see that the state still will retain full criminal jurisdiction, that the state will also, that is extended to civil and tribal jurisdictions, that perhaps if we don't recognize some of these things, some of the benefits in the state of Alaska will be lost through the federal money in maybe the neighborhood of $400 million to the state of Alaska?
I don't think so. I think Senator Stevens has made it clear when seeking appropriations for the state of Alaska, has never linked those appropriations to Indian tribes or Native sovereignty or Indian country. And, you know, are you referring to Public Law 280?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And is it clear from your understanding that all Native groups in Alaska recognize that Public Law 280 preserves the state's general criminal and civil jurisdiction in all Indian country?
That's correct. Under PLA.
So there's no question about that.
There's no question in my view under Section 1162.
And, but so we just take that a step farther. What about the powers of taxation in Indian country vis-a-vis the state and the Native tribe? Is that clear in your view, or is that sort of a muddy area?
To me, it's muddy at this particular time.
Mm-hmm. And let's take it just another step farther, if you would please, and talk about hunting and fishing in in Indian Country. Is it clear in your view that the state has the power to regulate all hunting and fishing in Indian Country?
Not if you look at Title 8 under ANILCA, that under federal laws that we can subsist and hunt and fish as deemed by those regulations.
Mm-hmm. And it's your view, as I gather what you're saying, that it's most beneficial that we have all these various units prescribing their own rights to hunt and fish?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to comment on that. You know, we discussed that when we were in Barrow. And I said to the questioner, I said, you live upriver or downriver? Well, we live upriver. I said, well, if you agree then that the downriver natives groups or tribes can regulate their own hunting and fishing along the river, then what's to prevent the downriver tribe from taking your fish? If they can take all they want and prescribe their own limits. You see?
Yeah.
Is that an illustration, I think, of the need for a broad statewide policy?
Yeah, that is your illustration, but my illustration on this is, doesn't go along with that. Here you are, the Attorney General of the Department of Law that's supposed to represent the state of Alaska and not just another group. And on this particular lawsuit, the Tyonic lawsuit, the state of Alaska is a friend of the court, and it should protect all people in the state of Alaska. It shouldn't go and try to reverse a case. That case is in has been litigated. Leave it be.
Senator, if there is anything as Attorney General I'm seeking to do is to represent all the peoples of this state, not just one particular group, because I think that's the great beauty of this state, and I think that's where the future of this state lies, and that's what we must do, is to form one people in this great state.
That is not the case in this, and I will wait for later to give other people questions on this policy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Adams, just I think I agree with what the Attorney General is saying with regard to the specific outcome of the Tyler case. I think it's difficult to look at excluding people racially from a community. And the question that I have for the Attorney General is, what happens to the appropriation process when we're asked to fund a sewer system, a runway, a road project, or a needed project in an area? I have voted for those projects in the past based on waivers of sovereign immunity. I voted for various pieces of legislation, always thinking that those pieces of legislation and those improvements were for all the people of the state of Alaska and that they wouldn't be utilized on any discriminatory basis. Do we have a problem constitutionally in the budgetary process if, in fact, we do have Indian Country in appropriating to essentially racially discriminatory purposes?
Pardon me, Senator?
I'm just going to debate that. We have federal law that nobody in state can be denied benefits on this, and we have some federal law that we can Chase versus Masters that is an old law case. We've got the Shakopee, an Indian Sioux tribe versus the Prior Lake on some of these issues. And somebody mentioned that the racial lines on the Tyokan decision has been interpreted to say that Indian tribes can discriminate based on their race. That is not incorrect. That is incorrect. The courts made it clear that tribes can give preferential treatment. And that's what they have stated there.
Is there a difference in preferential treatment and discrimination in your mind now?
None.
Thank you. Could you go ahead and answer?
Would you restate the question, please? I've sort of lost track of it.
The concern is that essentially we have for years voted on various pieces of legislation as well as budget appropriations, and they have been tied to waivers of potential immunity where it said this is not recognizing any immunity, but if any exists, it's waived, and so on and so forth. If, in fact, we really have sovereign entities, can we then appropriate the common resources of all the people of Alaska to specific purposes within those areas without legal problems under the state constitution guaranteeing equal provisions for all Alaskans?
May I defer that question and have Mr. Patello or Mr. Amendola answer it? But look, the principal problem, as I see it, Senator, is that question first lies with the legislature, rather as a matter of policy it wishes to do that. I can say this specifically, that with respect to agreements, and we're not even sure with whom, the Tyone Indian Country language exists, whether it's the Native Corporation Settlement Act Village Corporations, or whether it's any group that says they're a tribe. We're in, advising the various departments to obtain a waiver of sovereign immunity so as to permit the state to enforce its agreements when, say, water and sewer installations are made and their agreements with respect to their maintenance and operation. So we have to have that. Now, whether these recipients of those appropriations will in the future execute those waivers, we do not know. We hope they will.
With regard to the constitutional question and the public purpose restrictions and so forth, the Constitution in terms of expenditure of state funds, do we have a potential problem there? From, I guess I'm asking you, Mr. Amendola.
Mr. Chairman, Gary Amendola with the Department of Law. I guess the answer is yes, there's a potential problem, but there are ways of dealing with it. First of all, on a very basic level, Native Alaskans, just like everybody else, are citizens of the state of Alaska and are entitled to benefits on an equal basis. That's very clear. However, in a situation, on the other side of the coin, this legislature, when it is appropriating money for particular projects, is obligated to do so for a public purpose, for one. In order to ensure that your appropriations go for a public purpose, in the past there have been requested of what might be found to be Indian tribes waivers of sovereign immunity. The purpose of the waiver was to allow the state to ensure, whether through informal or more formal means, that the monies are spent properly. And one of those proper purposes, which has in the past been an expressed part of many of the grants, and I assume will be more so, is that the group to which it is given promise that they will spend it in a non-discriminatory basis. In other words, if it is going for a sewer system in Naknek, for example, the sewer system won't simply be hooked up to Native homes in the village. It will be hooked up to everybody's home. And in order for us to be able to ensure that that occurs, the waiver of sovereign immunity, of course, will be important, but also will also be contractual promises to do just that. I see that as the way that the legislature deal with appropriations that it makes in order to provide the benefits that it does to everybody in Alaska.
But the question is, if you have an appropriation to provide a sewer system to just an unnamed community, and that community becomes or is considered by the courts to be Indian country with authority to limit those people who can live there, then are you not in fact making an appropriation to a group that is racially defined and excludes others?
You're talking about a finding after the fact that makes it Indian country, and then perhaps.
Either way, because I think it's going to be the trail of being able to provide services, that regardless of what all the courts in the world say, it's going to come down to where the services are and where the money flows and where it comes from. But if you already have a determination that this place is Indian country, and it has exercised the decision not to allow non-members to be there, can you in fact appropriate to that entity and still meet the constitutional equal protection requirements and the other requirements of the state Bill of Rights?
You've identified a conflict that I'm not sure I have a clear answer for, except that one, I do not think that the decision on the merits, which hasn't been reached in Tyonek, will provide for such exclusions. If it does, then this legislature will be in a much more difficult situation with respect to that, and the answer may be with Congress.
So you're assuming that Tyonek will eventually be reversed?
I am assuming that the merits of the case, not necessarily that decision reversed, but the merits of the case have not yet been reached. And if they ever are reached, that they will not be decided in favor of allowing the native village of Tyonek to decide who may live there and who may not.
Senator Adams.
Do you feel that if there is any communities, native communities, that selects their local self-government, that a community can state to you that you have violated their civil rights, and that the long-term monetary liability will be great to the state of Alaska?
Senator, I'm not sure I followed that question. Could you...
On the same. Don't you think if we were denied any benefits, and he used the word water sewer projects in that particular community, don't you think that the civil rights violation would be in place then, and there would be perhaps a monetary liability against the state in cases like this, if you use federal guidelines and pass lawsuits?
Well, Senator, given what I've said about the judicial craftsmanship of the Ninth Circuit in this area, I don't think that I can give you an answer to that question with any assurance.
Thank you.
Representative Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is really more of a broader question than a limited one, and I think in terms of listening to the Attorney General, I certainly and perhaps others have an idea of how the Attorney General and perhaps the administration perceive sovereignty, and that view, the response that it has gotten from our colleague is that apparently is a negative view of sovereignty. And I guess what I would like to do is have either our colleague give us an idea of what his idea of sovereignty is, or perhaps someone in the audience. So because it seems to me that there's a difference here, that as you perceive sovereignty, it is beneficial and not negative. As you perceive sovereignty, it is perhaps detrimental and divisive. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is kind of something between the two. There has to be something between the two. It couldn't be as bad as you imagine, and there may be some problems with it as it's imagined by my colleague. And I guess I just would like to have the two views of what, from someone who's holds an opinion different than yours in terms of what they mean by sovereignty.
Well, that's fine. Thank you. I also offer the policy the thought that it might be worse, you see, than I've stated.
Yeah, Al, if either you or Georgiana want to respond to that, I just
Senator,
not go to somebody from either side outside of the committee or the...
No. Senator, Madam Senator, we would like to have a definition, and the response to this is somebody in the room. We will call on Will Mayo of Tanana Chiefs. He does not have to bring attorneys along to explain this. And if I can have Will
Senator,
Mayo.
Senator Adams, we are not going to take public testimony because then we'd have to call on the other side to do the
for
same
the
thing.
For the explanation.
Well, why don't you explain?
No, go ahead.
Either you or...
Well, we wanted somebody from the tribal that has been working on it, and that's fixed.
I would like I'd like the opportunity to call on special counsel to respond.
Okay.
5 minutes each.
Five minutes each.
Will.
Okay.
Right here. Would you state your name for a second? 5 minutes.
Maybe you can have it, Chair.
Okay. My name is Will Mayo, and I'm the president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. And I've been listening to the comments very carefully, with great interest, of course. And I just wanted to point out a couple things. Sovereignty, basically, is the right of a people to be self-governing. And it includes, as one of the aspects of it, this idea of sovereign immunity that concerns the state. The right of self-government for indigenous peoples is a very has a very old history of protection in the international scene, as well as under our United States Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, and Clause 3 of the United States Constitution says that only Congress shall have the shall be able to regulate relations with tribes, foreign nations, and the several states. What this did was it established a relationship between the tribes and the federal government that was not, and the state was not invited to be a party to. I understand that, however, the state does have concerns and has the right to express those. Basically, the founding fathers and drafters of the United States Constitution realized that they could not do less than Spain, France, England in recognizing the self-governing rights of Native Americans. Congress later said that that you could not take away that right. Only Congress has the right. And when they do so, they must do so clearly and very explicitly. They have never done that in Alaska. Never. You'll find no case law. You'll find no federal statute that has ever, quote, terminated, unquote, Alaska tribes. So our relationship is based on the U.S. Constitution. This is why the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with the Founding Fathers, because they could see very clearly that what we have here is the basic human rights of indigenous populations not to be overrun, not to be abused, annihilated, either through weapons or pens or laws. And in their just ruling, in my opinion, they have once again established that the tribes of Alaska are not to be treated unlike indigenous populations in the rest of the United States. Therefore, they found under federal law that the native lands in Alaska, the Inksa lands, fell under the same definitions of lands set aside for Indians. And when they did that, it became Indian country because of the federal law that developed based on the United States Constitution. If my family owned Juneau, my extended family, if we owned Juneau in every building, we would have the right to tell whoever we wanted to that they could be here. We would have the right to tell whoever we didn't want to whether they would have to leave. This is not an exact corollary or an exact example, but it is similar to the recognition of the rights of tribes recognized under our under federal Indian law based on the United States Constitution. And in closing, I think I don't want to wear out my welcome, be that such as. But I would like to just close by saying that in most of the states in the United States where there are Indian tribes exercising their God-given right to self-government based on their indigenous status, the states have a very cooperative relationship. Yes, they have disputes. Yes, they have areas that need to be sometimes acted upon in the courts. But for the most part, and I have had a great amount of experience or contact with other tribes, the relationships are friendly, and where they disagree, they take each other to court, but they don't seek to disallow or not to recognize the tribal governments. And they have some very good relationships, co-jurisdictions, cross-jurisdictions, cross-deputizations, sharing of resources, and various types of agreements all across this country. And it's not a relationship different between neighboring cities or boroughs. And the one difference is that sovereignty is self-government as guaranteed under the United States Constitution to Native Americans. And again, the states are not do not regulate that. The federal government does. So I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your explanation, and I guess in listening to you talk, and you obviously are quite knowledgeable, and I guess I feel kind of embarrassed at my lack of knowledge, so I'll apologize in advance for any dumb questions that I might ask. But I guess in terms of an observer of the situation, that I see that there seems to be a perception, and I get that from some of the comments I've heard, not just from this administration but previous administrations, that the constitutional right and that relationship that you've described between indigenous tribes and, say, our federal constitution, there seems to be a perception, and or part of that argument seems to be that relationship that you've identified was set aside by ANILCA. And what I'm hearing from you and is that is not the case.
No. It's very clear in the federal law that tribes cannot be terminated, that is, their self-government powers be taken from them, without a very express and clear statement from the Congress. Such a statement has never occurred. Section 2B of ANCSA says that we won't create any more reservations or any more wardships. It didn't address those that already existed or the relationship that pre-existed ANCSA. And so my answer is absolutely not. There has been no termination of that unique relationship between tribes, Native Americans, and the federal government in Alaska. And that's why the Ninth Circuit decided the way they did.
Mr. Chairman, if I may say that an area was given sovereignty, how would that change what's happening now, let's say, in any particular area? How would the lives of the people in that area, how would they be impacted?
Well, from the Native point of view, there would be the benefit, because under the state system of government, the great fear of Alaska Natives is not, the desire is not that we lord it over anyone. The desire is that we protect what we have left. The protection is not given to us as a Native indigenous peoples in our culture under state law or under the state constitution, because wherever state municipal subdivisions exist, the Native people can look forward to being dominated in the voting booths, so that their culture, their community, their age-old, their ancient homeland can eventually be wrested from them through that process. And that's the whole reason that Congress recognized the special relationship and that they have such a thing as Indian country, because they recognize that Indians lose everything. In the 500th year of our contact, you'll see that we have exactly in the neighborhood of 4.4% of the land base that we had at one time. The remainder is 95.2% is in the hands of what we call the United States. Congress wanted to guarantee that Native Americans could hold on to what little they have left for their future, and to recognize their right to do that. Under the state constitution, we could never do that. In all respect, the North Slope Borough is a primarily Eskimo population, and under that, they can make regulations and laws for themselves that protect, to a certain degree, their culture. But eventually, someday, they're going to be outnumbered, and they'll begin to lose that edge. Under Indian law and under Indian country, that can't happen. The natives are protected, their culture, their rights as indigenous peoples, not to be shunted aside and become part of this so-called melting pot, which is not an Indian term.
So sovereignty then is a mechanism or a means to not only protect, but perhaps reinforce and continue the culture and prevent annihilation of the Native peoples. Is that how you see it?
That's one important part, but the most important part was that just men saw what it is true, what their mothers taught them, that it is not right to take what isn't yours. And that is why when they came to this country and they saw these human beings with their governments, their forms of life, their culture, already in existence, they said that no state or foreign country shall have the power to regulate our relationship with these people. Only the federal, only Congress. And the reason was they feared what almost eventually happened anyway, complete assimilation of a people. So it was a sense of justice that was well-founded and based. In fact, it was the very reason that they created this country, to get away from monarchs, unfair forms of government that annihilated their rights and their people, and so they chose to recognize the Native Americans as a sovereign people. And in federal terms, it's more accurate to refer to it as a suzerainty. And it's a sort of, in a sense, a modified sovereignty. Because Indians cannot form an army, they can't have a post office. There's a lot of things that we can't do. But we have a modified form of sovereignty. And it's worked for all these centuries. And Alaska, being the last frontier, is going to be the last place where the Indian wars are going to occur.
Yeah,
and that's
what
we're seeing.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just if I could ask a couple of, just so I understand what you said.
Okay.
I think you said that essentially the village of Tyonek should be able to exclude non-members. Is that correct?
Well, that is the one of the powers that tribes have on their lands.
Okay. Dominated in the voting booth, I think that means that the voting for the governmental entity in Indian country should be limited to tribal members?
Well, that's part of the definition of a sovereignty, is to define what its constituency is.
Okay. That was just two clarifications. I would kind of like to go back to the Attorney General, and if you'd like to call Doug Mertz.
May I address a question to Mr. Mayor before he leaves?
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask the question through you. Of course, Mr. Mayo said that there are some limits on tribal sovereignty, such as an inability to form an army or print money, perhaps, or to establish a postal system. But what limits on self-government in Indian country are there besides those, in your view?
One of the most important ones, which already has been referred to in this forum, is the in this hearing, is the that affects Alaska and a number of other Western states, is Public Law 280, which in effect says that tribal governments and state governments shall exercise co-jurisdiction on lands. That is one of the greatest limitations to the extent of tribal sovereignty that we face in this state and in some others. There is how that is actually worked out on the ground is differed and varied with the different states, from at least one state having given up its right to have co-jurisdiction on Indian lands, and other states having memorandums of agreements with the tribes on how jurisdiction would be handled in the various areas. So, you know, I see that as one of the limitations. And of course, as you have stated, while we've been talking in a lot of generalities, a lot of details of what this all means would have to be worked out. And some of that would be worked out either in a friendly forum of the state sitting with the tribes and saying, well, let's negotiate out how we deal with this, or through the courts, as we have been doing.
Well, for example, is the do the state's criminal laws apply in Indian country, in your view?
Well, I'm not an attorney, and I get into very shaky ground here.
Okay.
But I will say that that the because of 280 and because of other federal law, tribes do not have the authority to do not have jurisdiction over capital crimes such as murder and rape and such as things as that. But in areas of, and I'm not sure of the term, but in other criminal activities, motor vehicle issues and, you know, that kind of thing, tribes can have jurisdiction and often do. But so that's the best I can do. I'm not. I'd be glad to communicate with you on another.
I'd kind of like to have
Mr. Mertz
give us the definition of sovereignty, I guess, from the Attorney General's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope it is from the Attorney General's office point of view. I have not worked for the Attorney General since last June, and although I've offered him an occasional piece of advice off and on, we have not discussed any of these questions here today, and what I'll tell you is what I think.
Okay.
After dealing with the problem
but
of sovereignty...
If you don't think it, you don't have to pay it.
Right. Thank you. Furthermore, you won't appropriate the money to pay him. So. But maybe he could start with, if you don't mind, who are the tribes? I mean, who are the tribes under?
You have to break down the legal question into several big categories, one of which is, who are tribes? What are tribes? Are there tribes here? It has been a long time since the state, if it ever, really took the position that there can never be tribes here, that somehow federal law says that there are no tribes in Alaska. There's some ancient case law that says that. But the fact is, I believe the state's position is, and my own belief is, that there can be tribes here, and some native villages are tribes. Maybe most of the native villages who are on the ANCSA list of native villages, probably some of them don't qualify as tribes under the federal criteria because they're not traditional organizations or haven't had a continuous political existence. But there probably are tribes. Now, having said that, it doesn't get you very far because it doesn't tell you what powers they have. Sovereign powers, in the sense of governmental powers or immunities from, say, state governmental authority, would come only if a tribe occupied Indian country. So that's the next big question. What is Indian country? Reservations are Indian country. We've only got one reservation here. There were others, but all the others were eliminated by ANCSA, except for the Metlakatla Annette Island Reserve. Allotments are Indian country with some special rules that apply to them. Then there's this third category, dependent Indian communities. This is the category which that Ninth Circuit panel on Tyonek used and which the at least the lawyers among the sovereignty advocates base their hopes of establishing areas of sovereignty on. Dependent Indian communities are geographical areas which are in some sense equivalent to reservations where the land is set aside by the federal government for the use and protection of native inhabitants, and the natives are in some sense, which is not clearly defined in the law, dependent on the federal government. There's lots of case law. What applies here or doesn't is a good question, and we've got cases all over the map, including from the Ninth Circuit, on what that means. Now, if the areas around some native villages were found to be Indian country, and the native village was found to be a tribe, then you get to your third question is, what have we got now? What powers do they have? Or what immunities from state law do they have? And here again, in Alaska, without reservations, there are a lot of unknowns. The factor that is looming large over the whole question now is that we have a very conservative United States Supreme Court, which in the last few years has issued several decisions that have cut way back on the prerogatives of self-government of a tribe in Indian country, basically saying that the powers of the tribe are limited to self-government, very limited powers over non-members, and very limited immunities from state jurisdiction. But here again, this law is just in a formative, changing period, so nobody can say with certainty what these exact powers would be. And we know PL 280 says that for Alaska and several other states, the state has criminal jurisdiction in all Indian country. There's a big exception to that rule that says that goes for true crimes, but not for civil regulatory offenses, things that are really civil regulations that just happen to have a criminal penalty attached. Bingo was the case that brought this to the U.S. Supreme Court first. Now we have in the courts a case here involving hunting, and the question is a hunting violation, an out-of-season violation, a true criminal violation, in which case the state would have jurisdiction, or is it one of these civil regulatory ones, in which case, if it were a tribe within Indian country, the state wouldn't have jurisdiction. We already have one ruling on that from the federal district court, which said that, you know, hunting and fishing crimes are crimes, like any other crime, so the state has jurisdiction. But the question has been raised again in this current litigation. The only other comment I can make is just thinking of Mr. Mayo's comments, which I thought were very articulate and should be paid attention to. There is a lot of historical justification for his approach and some justification in the case law, the problem being that this is an area where you can find case law justification for almost any proposition you want, but still, it's his views are something that should be paid close attention to because I believe they reflect a very common view. I would break down sovereignty into two separate viewpoints. One that is very common among native villagers, particularly, that they feel a lack of control over the things that matter in their own lives. And that's what they want most of all, the ability to deal locally with local problems. And they don't have it now, and they want to have it in some way. The other more developed viewpoint on sovereignty is that which I mentioned earlier, which is mostly the lawyer's point of view about how the existing case law and statutory law can lead you to a situation where you have these enclaves of Indian country in which tribes have real governmental powers and tribal members have real immunities, limited immunities from state law. That is the type of sovereignty which I believe does not have a very good chance of being fully realized in the courts, particularly with our present United States Supreme Court. But to the extent that Congress recognizes the problem and grants special statutory privileges, then they will indeed have a basis for some sort of self-determination. And in the meantime, the basic view out on the villages is something that really ought to be paid attention to by state government, because while us lawyers have spent these years wrangling about it, in a lot of the villages, the people have just been going ahead and doing it. And they're leaving the rest of us, lawyers and legislators, in the dust by creating their own living institutions out there, whether they're legal or not.
With regard to just kind of understanding what sovereignty means, because I think that's what Virginia asked both directions, I've just got a number of categories. If you would try to give us a quick answer, sovereignty, I assume, includes the power to limit the franchise.
The most extreme form of it does.
Okay.
A reservation sovereignty would.
Okay. Does sovereignty include the power to limit ownership within the area covered?
There is no clear answer, but I believe not unless it was sanctioned by federal law, and federal law does with some things like what you do with an allotment. There are restrictions on what can be done with native-owned land.
How about limiting residency?
Well, one of the things that you're always told when you're taught Indian law is that a reservation tribe has the ability to limit residents on a reservation to members of the tribe, but that they almost never do, because if they did, Congress would change the rules. That's the common viewpoint.
Okay, how about limiting the use of facilities within this enclave or whatever you call it?
Tribal governmental facilities, they probably do with some restrictions, and it gets to the question of where the facilities are from, what they're funded by. To get right to the question that you were posing before and Senator Adams was, what if the state provides funding for a particular facility? The state has its own constitutional provisions for public purpose and non-discrimination, and what if the local tribal government wants to limit its use to tribal members? We do not have law directly on that point, I believe, but my belief is that the courts would ultimately say that the state can condition grants of state public funds on an agreement not to discriminate in use of the public funds. But it is not 100% clear.
How about taxation?
Taxation is, well, there's taxation both ways, except for some areas that are limited.
Exemption
like
from state taxation, ability to
state
impose
taxation.
Own taxation. Both directions.
Right. As far as state taxation goes, generally in Indian country, residents of Indian country, native residents, would be obligated to pay state taxes except in some special situations, for instance, involving direct taxes on allotments. And the exceptions that exist in ANCSA, for ANCSA, taxation of ANCSA land. In the other direction, taxation by a tribe of non-members or even of the state, I believe, again, no clear law, but I believe that the courts will ultimately say that unless the tribe can show that that kind of taxation is essential to the internal relations of the tribe, which is the formula that the U.S. Supreme Court has used, that they could not do it.
How about the power to limit commerce or regulate commerce?
The same standard would apply as far as regulating commerce of non-members, that it could not be justified unless it was essential for regulating the internal affairs of the tribe.
And regulating the use of natural resources, fish and game, and other natural resources?
It's the same thing, same standard. With natural resources, with fish and game, there is yet another limitation, which is that the courts have said that the states have the ability to regulate on reservations in Indian country where it's necessary for conservation of the resource. Here again, it's a lot of really hazy rules, but that's the general shape of them.
Okay. Georgiana, you've sat here all this time. I appreciate your tolerance as we get back. You had some questions, I think, for the Attorney General, and you need to go to a House Resources Committee. So
I want you to stay.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate you allowing me to ask a question. I know that this is a very controversial subject. And Mr. Mertz has in part answered the question, I guess, that I was going to ask of the Attorney General Cole, and that is that when going back to a statement that you made earlier that the governor desired several things, one that you stated, you know, his firm opposition to the sovereignty issue, and then you went on to say that the administration is very much opposed to the litigation versus the political process. And you used as example the clean water, sewage, justice, and that the rural Alaska problems are best addressed through legislation. And what Mr. Mertz said, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name, was that sovereignty, that several definitions of it. One was lack of control over the villages. And looking at addressing problems of the villages through legislation, I'm having a real difficult time with that, and I thought maybe you could expound on that a little bit. When we have 212 villages that are still using primarily honey buckets and slop buckets, where we have villages that are have cardboard nailed to the inside of the houses for insulation, when we have no justice, as you spoke about, in the majority of our villages, when our block grants are cut back, when our education is at an all-time low, not only in Alaska but throughout the United States, when our employment is disastrous out there in bush Alaska, when I can't get a local hire bill through the legislative process, and when development is the primary source of the Alaska economy from bush Alaska, and yet development, roads, etc., is not in bush Alaska unless the planning comes from the top down. There is no control that I see that is coming from the rural communities upward. And I think that if the administration desires to have the political process instead of litigation, then it would appear that we need to have this discussion with the local communities. And so I just wonder if you could respond to that. Perhaps you have some light at the end of the tunnel there that I can't see.
We can answer your question with another question. Do you think sovereignty will get you clean water in the villages and sewer systems in the villages faster?
If I might respond,
please.
I very truly believe with all my heart and soul that the villages, if they had more control out there of the services, that they definitely could administer the programs that they desire out there and not have so many programs that are put out there from the top down that they don't desire, and a lot of money that is misspent, misallocated, not from programs that they desire. And the Indian Child Welfare is a good example of a positive of where the local communities have control. Village public safety officers are another very positive. Limited tribal courts is another very positive where there's local control. Yes, sir, I do.
Well, but hear me. Those gains in the rural villages came by way of legislation, not by tribal sovereignty. And I am saying that it's the governor's view, the view to which I subscribe, that the best way to realize the ends which the rural villages seek is by way of legislation, not by years and years of expensive, time-consuming, divisive litigation. And you and Senator Adams here in this very legislature, exercising the political strength which you have, are best able to achieve those benefits for the villages rather than by summoning lawyers who argue endlessly for years and years, and as Mr. Mertz said, with really very little to show for it. Listen to what he said about what lies uncertain. Do you realize that years of litigation lie ahead for the resolution of every single issue which he mentioned? The solution, I implore you, is legislation and agreements to achieve these ends, not tribal sovereignty. And I assure you, furthermore, that tribal sovereignty will not bring prosperity to Allakaket. I mean, what it brings these benefits to the rural villages, you know, is essentially an inflow of wealth into those communities. And until that happens, I mean, sovereignty will not achieve these ends. And that's something I fervently believe. I've been in the native villages in interior Alaska for 30 years. And today they're worse off than they were 30 years ago, in many ways, in my view. Certainly there's been some gains, but very little to show for 30 years.
It's almost a two-sided question from my perspective. I think that small local units that are more understandable to the people dealing with it probably make the system work better in terms of delivering service. But I think it's much, much harder to convince a majority of the rest of the people of Alaska to allocate the resources into an area if, in fact, you really had sovereignty. So those, you know, I think it might work better. It might be more efficient because you'd have less overlapping layers and traditional governments can work more easily without some of the restrictions. But I think if you actually had the divisions of sovereignty, I think the ability to convince the legislature and the executive branch to appropriate money would be much more difficult. We'd be further away from the one people side that gets the money to do the job, which you could probably do more efficiently in traditional governments.
Absolutely, there would be more efficiency there. And I apologize for asking my question and having to run, but I am chairing another committee. Thank you for your time.
Senator Adams.
Yes. One of the things that we need to do if we want to stop this particular process, I was hoping that the state would stay out of the Tione case and not try to reverse something they're just a friend of the court with. And perhaps that if we're going to need use our political strength, then we need to reduce the Department of Law's budget in that particular case and get on with the statewide issues so that we can work on something. But
he knows
to you,
how
Mr.
to hurt a guy.
Mr. Mertz, since it's very unclear that we have unknown answers, and there's a lot of unknowns, both in sovereignty, Indian country, and in tribes, do you think that we as legislators and Department of Law and the Hickel administration should use as guidelines the federal laws that are presently in statute and federal laws that such as PLA 280, that present lawsuits that had happened on other tribes and their particular ruling, and utilize these on guidelines in forming this sovereignty or any regulations on Indian country and tribes or any legislation?
Senator, first, this is not something I've discussed with all with the Attorney General. So
but you sound good
today.
I think before we get into the debate, I think we need to let the Attorney General state the state's position.
I was asking Mr. Marks.
Let me respond to that, because I would like to. You see, Senator, I probably, perhaps more than you, recognize Indian tribes and Indian reservations in the states than you. My father grew up on an Indian reservation, and I spent a good part of my early years on an Indian reservation, specifically the Yakima Reservation. And I know the boundaries of the Yakima Reservation, and I know what incredibly fertile lands in an economic agricultural powerhouse that reservation is. And so look at the Yakima Reservation there, such as it is, one of the most fertile agricultural counties and areas in the world, and compare that with Venetai, and compare it with Allakaket and Alignikik. I mean, you're dealing with concepts which are as different as night and day. And you're never, never going to make those villages what the Navajo lands are or what the Yakima tribes' lands are or the Puyallup tribal lands are. I mean, you're just dealing in concepts and economic relationships and indeed political and social relationships which are dramatically different. And I think it's a mistake for the Alaska Natives to try to equate themselves with those socioeconomic unit. So, you know, I just urge you to give pause to endeavor to link Alaska Native claims into those of the South 48. Thank you.
I'd like my question responded by Mr. Mertz. It was just on the guidelines.
If we could just briefly do that, and then I'd like to at least have a few minutes for Mr. Amendola to go through the thing that he did for us. Go ahead.
Perhaps with this response, then he could follow that response through this response.
Are we sure which response we're dealing with?
This response.
Your question was, should
yes.
we follow all these federal laws, case law, guidelines?
As guidelines, since there's very unclear and unknown answers out there that we have history behind us, we have PLA 280, we have lawsuits that have happened on tribes, and should we as legislators and Department of Law and the administration at least look at these and follow these as guidelines on the sovereignty questions?
You've got to look at them, but in the long run, I recommend that legislators, the administration, Native leaders, village leaders, collectively decide to put them aside, put aside the law, come together without any restrictions or preconceptions based on what the law is or might be or what anyone hopes it is, bar all lawyers from the discussion, and just get down to brass tacks and decide what the problems out there are and what the best ways of dealing with them are, regardless of what the present law might be. That's what I recommend.
Thank you, sir.
See, Senator, I learned years ago in the practice of the law, I never ask a question on cross-examination, and I'm not sure of the answer. Thank you. But let me say one last thing. I would like to say this. In the end, it will be the economics which will dictate and control it. And that is what I think the Alaska Native sovereignty people should keep their eye on. That is what maybe not next year, 10 years, but 20 and 30 and 40 years, that will tell the tale. Thank you.
Could we go to Mr. Amendola and go through the questions that we
I'll
had
leave
here?
Now. Thank you.
Oh, you're going to try and escape.
I just have a question before
okay.
you leave.
Don't let him get away. Thank go you. Ahead.
Okay. What is the administration doing other than litigation or litigating to resolve the issue?
I'll tell you what we are doing. We're standing in readiness to meet with the native leaders, as Mr. Mertz has suggested, to address these issues. I'm not sure we can kick all the lawyers out, but we would try very much to do that, put Senator Adams in.
Instead of one of the lawyers? That would be good. Thank you.
For those that couldn't hear the AG, he's willing to sit down and at least talk with the Alaska Natives on some of these issues, and they couldn't hear you in the back there, Charlie. So that's basically had stated there.
Thank you, Senator. And yeah. Thank you for allowing
thank you.
Me the opportunity to appear here today.
Thank you. If we could just briefly go through the cases that Mr. Amendola responded to on an overview in writing. And those that we've already essentially covered, you can skip over, but if you just give us a brief overview of the individual cases you cited there and any other questions that were in my letter memorandum that you want to address, if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, after all that's already been said and the questions that have been asked and answered, I'm not sure where to begin. Let me just say, though, that the memorandum that or the letter that I provided to you with the current status of litigation towards the back was an attempt to, as objectively as possible, describe to you what federal laws, and ultimately this is a question of federal law, what federal law says about tribal status, Indian country, and sovereignty in general. I'll leave it to you to decide whether I was objective or not, but that was certainly the intent to not debate the issue, but simply provide you with some background materials. With respect to the cases, I've identified all of the litigation which is current, both in the federal and state court, in which the state has either been a party or been involved as an amicus, with one exception, the Nome Eskimo community case. The state of Alaska did not participate in that case at all. The status of each of those cases was current as February 6th when I sent you this memo. And I guess if there's not questions about them, or if there are, I'd be happy to answer them. I'm not quite sure.
Well, would you tell us which are the most significant ongoing cases in your mind?
Certainly.
February 11th.
In terms of significant ongoing cases, obviously Puckett versus Native Village of Tyonek, as I indicate in my memo, that the Ninth Circuit has recently ruled on the issue of sovereign immunity for the Native Village of Tyonek, and in doing so made some statements which indicated that the Village Corporation land in and around the Native Village was Indian country, that if one of the defendants, and we believe that at least one of the defendants will petition for to the U.S. Supreme Court for review, that petition must be filed on or before April 13th. Thereafter, a party opposing the petition or a party who wishes, as an amicus, to support the petition, and that would be the state of Alaska, would be intending to file an amicus supporting the petition for review. That would have to be filed 30 days thereafter, i.e., on or before May 13th. Thereafter, between then and July 1st, when the court goes into summer recess, it may or may not decide whether to grant certiorari, which is grant the right to grant the petition for review. If it doesn't do so, it will likely not decide that whether it's even going to review the case until it returns for the October term.
But the and state's position, in short, is that we are going to support the review by the Supreme Court, and then if the review is taken up, that the state of Alaska will be an amicus on the side of reversal of that case.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Next case.
The next case that's ongoing is the second case, State of Alaska versus Native Village of Venati. That case has gone up to the Ninth Circuit once on a preliminary injunction. It is now back in the U.S. District Court, and procedurally it is at a point where the case has been set for trial in the fall, and the trial is on the issue of whether or not the Native Village of Venati is a tribe and whether or not it occupies Indian country. It is the intention of the court during that trial to take testimony from both persons who live in Venati and Ark Village on the circumstances under which they live, and to take testimony from experts, anthropological and otherwise, about the historical roots of the Native Village of Venati and the country around there before it tries to make a determination as to whether or not Venati is a tribe and whether it is Indian country. As I said, that case is set for trial for next fall. However, it's my understanding that there may be some consideration to holding off that